On the programme, Theatre and Politics, Making Enduring Art Out of Political Crisis. Hello and welcome to the Project Arts Centre in Dublin and this public discussion as part of the 2013 Dublin Theatre Festival. It seems appropriate to look at theatre and politics in this centenary year of the 1913 general strike and lockout in Dublin. And who but a dreaming and hard-headed playwright or poet could have anticipated the state of Ireland 100 years after those events and 90 years after independence, all that delirium of the brave. From those bitter years of conflict, we have a few searing plays of witness and enduring worth. But what of now, and the plays of witness and worth to mark these times of profound social trauma and change? Can theatre truly reflect what's current in a way that will sustain, in a way that goes beyond polemic and makes enduring art? Does it have any duty to attempt to engage with current social and political realities? And how does Irish theatre compare to other international theatre in seeking to do so or doing so? Some of the questions here today. Our panel, Fiach MacAneill, artistic director since 2005 of the Abbey Theatre. He's also a senator and was founder of the civic movement We the Citizens. Joe Lawler is one half with Christine Malloy of the creative partnership Desperate Optimists. Their play Tom and Vera has just been running at the current festival and their feature film Mr. John has opened at the IFI in Dublin and selected cinemas. From Canada, Marcus Youssef is artistic director of the Vancouver company New World Theatre, which co-presents with Theatre Replacement, Winners and Losers at the current festival. He's a member of Vancouver's newly appointed Arts and Culture Advisory Council. Helen Meaney is an arts journalist, critic and consultant. She reviews theatre for The Guardian and is literature advisor to the Arts Council. And Willie White is director of the Dublin Theatre Festival and, like Fiach MacAneill, a former director of the Project Arts Centre, where we are today. So, the current crisis as reflected in theatre. I suppose we should begin by trying to define or identify some of the current crises that any art form might seek to address. There is the financial, obviously, but there are international human crises around technology, religious conflict, energy and natural resources, not to mention who's monitoring your email, Facebook and Twitter accounts and why. I'd like to get a sense of what each of our panellists regards as the crisis issues theatre can or might or should address. And I think we leave the business of comparing Ireland to other countries till later. Marcus Youssef, what crisis do you try to address as a theatre maker and what's addressed in your show Winners and Losers at this year's festival?
I think there's two answers to that question. The first would be that, like, for a long time, my company, just purely out of my interest and the interest of folks I work with, has been very curious and provoked and wanted to address in some way relationships between particularly North America and the Middle East and the kind of post 9/11 context. That's been a real, I'm of Egyptian descent. My longtime colleague, an artist named Kamir Chai, is of Persian descent, and that's been a real question for us and something we felt like there was a tremendous amount of silence about or a tremendous amount of kind of one perspective about that we always wanted to kind of deal with in any number of shows. However, this show, Winners and Losers, that we brought to the festival is actually quite a bit different. It doesn't deal with the Middle East or questions of whatever, Islamophobia or the clash of civilizations or any of that kind of stuff at all. Jamie and I from Theatre Replacement, James Long, we were interested in the question of class and not so much, I think, in the context you guys are dealing with because you've been hit much, much harder than we have in Canada. We've been insulated by any number of factors. But the issue of class and privilege and how and competition and the engine of our economy that is driven by this idea was something that was of great interest to us because it's something that in Canada, maybe less so than here, it's a taboo. Class is the last taboo. Race is not a taboo in the same way in Canada, I would say. But class and privilege and questions of wealth are not spoken about. And so that's something we really wanted to tackle.
Helen Meaney, for you, what are the crises of our times that theatre should or does engage with?
You've touched on some of them in your introduction, but I suppose here in Ireland it's a sense of people feeling disenfranchised, marginalised, excluded, the loss of faith in sort of institutions, including our political institutions, and of course, obviously, more recently, the church. I mean, these are all things that are being explored by theatre makers. Some of the things that are explored less, I think, are issues of youth suicide and the pressures that technology is placing on particularly young people and young women, and the whole sort of sexualization of young women and the sort of rise of porn and the way that's affecting relations and the way social media is fueling that. That's something that I feel is a real becoming a real problem for teenagers, and we're not quite probably addressing that very much in Irish theatre, but I'm sure it is to come.
Fiacc MacAneill, what would you see as the urgent issues theatre in general should address? And I don't want to confine you to Ireland or to the Abbey, our national theatre.
I don't know. I think I depend on artists really to tell me what the issues that are kind of the most pressing. And yes, I have a list of what I consider. I mean, I think the discussion here is very welcome, because there's two things we should look at. One is you know, how you deal with particular issues, or should a director of a national theatre or a director of have a list and an agenda of issues that they should just tick off on a particular year. Secondly, is to give the scope and the imagination and the non-censorious kind of permission to writers to write what they want to write, and for us to actually hear that. And I can give a couple of examples of that. And the final thing is how our theatre community is or is not political, okay, with in the sense of how has our theatre community in Ireland, for instance, and you can see the difference in perhaps, one could argue the difference in Britain or neighbour, how politicised are they as a community, that in their collective work, and all its diversity, have made an impact, or certainly have shown, have heard a voice or a ripple in terms of public policy. In terms of, so there's many strands of that, and I deal with all those kind of strands. And but as an introduction, you know, I would say that we are probably, as a community, the most depoliticized, the most disengaged. However, the work that I've seen, particularly in the independent sector, and particularly I see a lot of younger theatre makers who as citizen artists, are communicating and trying to deal with the kind of with the political system. That doesn't mean their work has to be political or with a capital P, but so that's fascinating. So it's a good sign. In terms of what Helen's mentioning, I think I can pick a play by Stacey Gregg called Perv, which is an extraordinary play, which looks at how technology is the other in a family situation now, and is the other. In fact, Nancy Harris also, in her recent play, No Romance, dealt with that as well. Now, you know, how you deal with technology as an instrument of theatre making, and how you deal with technology as an otherness within, almost like a character within a play, I think is now certainly in what might be considered traditional literary text, which is what I deal with largely. I think there's a technology is becoming very much an otherness within, and the character, and Perv by Stacey Gregg would have been a primary example of that.
And we'll return to that issue of again, politics within the theatre community. Willie White, perhaps we're seeing, or will see, some of what you regard as urgent in the intersection of theatre and life in this festival. I know you get to see a great deal of international theatre. In doing so, do you spot common anxieties or shared issues around politics and society in international theatre?
I guess when you're thinking about what issues are the ones that should be discussed, it's really a matter of take your pick. There are lots of issues. And depending on the place that you're seeing work, it could be, for example, I was in Chile at the beginning of this year. It's 40 years from the anniversary of the coup. People are very preoccupied with that. They're in a post-conflict situation like we are in Ireland. Look at a play like Quietly, which was presented recently in the Peacock, and then in Edinburgh would be another kind of equivalent example.
Owen McCafferty's play.
Indeed. But I think in a way, we in Ireland, in our politics, we've become quite introspective or self-involved. It tends to be the politics of Ireland rather than necessarily politics around globalisation, which we felt the effects of in recent years. Or even something that I can't think of many examples of playwrights who've made something about the ecological crisis at the moment. I mean, technology, if you use that word, and I suppose I would consider technology, it's not my invention, but my definition is stuff that's been invented since we were born is technology. So there's always been technology in the theatre, whether it was a candle or an electric lantern. But I think that there's been a massive disruption, particularly from the internet in general in the world. You look at what's happened to retail, you look at what has happened to the way that people relate with each other, you look at controversies in our recent presidential election or around the use of social media. So it really is a matter of take your pick as to how you can enforce something that you think is your own preoccupation. With Fiacc, it depends on the work. Perhaps what you think is important will cause you to look in particular directions, but you have to be aware of your own prejudices, but also be alert to what artists are doing.
So, you know, would you have made an attempt to bring particularly politically engaged work to this year's festival.
Yes, but I suppose in the broadest sense, so you can look at something, a piece like Winners and Losers, which is very explicitly about class, but not just about class, about, you know, using personal relations, exploding that into global relationships. A piece from Portugal, which is an historical story about censorship. We've had our own experience of that in the Portuguese case during the Salazar regime. It was of theatre. And in a way, almost for me, that's an affirmation of theatres. What I'd like to believe is theatre's power to subvert, in the case of Tokushiki Okada, Shellfish's Ground and Floor, that's an account by a playwright of what, according to them, is going on in contemporary Japan, which is a malaise that's a mixture of lots of different crises, an economic crisis, a cultural crisis, and a crisis caused by the earthquake and Fukushima reactor. So that these are, in different kinds of ways, political. And again, I suppose it's interesting to reflect in Ireland what we mean by political. We constantly berate ourselves that we haven't, with everything that's going on, been manning the barricades or womaning the barricades as we did 100 years ago. Why is that? What, when we say politics, Fintan Walsh has written an essay in a publication called That Was Us, which Oberon Books are bringing out during the festival. And he talks about the politics being a politics of effect. It's not necessarily something that throws people out on the streets to march, but it changes people's opinions and their sensibilities. So I guess it's not necessarily party politics, but it's individual politics that are collectively expressed.
On that theme, you know, individual politics and the impact of the larger storm on people, on human beings. Joel Oller, your production Tom and Vera, superficially at least, a classically constructed story about a couple of negative equity who take it upon themselves to get their money back from the bank. And it kind of goes wrong. Money or lack of it as a crisis, but then that builds to something more desperate and primal and becomes a very human crisis. Tell me a little bit about the shaping of that and you're looking at that kind of financial crisis through the individual eye.
Well, I just to go back on that original question or the initial question to do with what theatre should address in terms of a crisis, and I'll try and try and segue into that question. I mean, just to put a face on theatre essentially is theatre makers, and so I would say they shouldn't address any crisis if they don't want to. So that really is for them ultimately to decide about what their own obsessions may well be, but it may well be that their obsessions have bigger relationships to the society around them, and so it's interesting to see how that might take shape. I mean, we never knowingly or never kind of consciously set forth to address a crisis or a specific social theme, but I was just thinking about this on the way in here. Actually, there's been a number of shows and films that we have done which seem to do so quite explicitly, or at least they have a kind of an outer layer or an exoskeleton where you could say, well, that seems to be addressing the issue of poverty or wealth. Actually, we did this performance many years ago when Fiuk was at the project, addressing that specific issue. And I remember there was a critic, Luke Clancy, that was called in for questioning by the police because of it, because we'd send off these threatening communiques to very wealthy people. So it was an interesting time to look at how this cultural sphere bounced up against the police force and what happened in that frisson. So, but the idea wasn't necessarily to kind of throw out the issue so much as to look at how that would really have relationship to the formal investigation of theatre. So we were very interested in not just the content, but also how that was going to be expressed. So I think for us, and I suspect that is the case for all theatre makers, it's not just what it is, but how it is as well. So I think I would kind of throw that as an important thing. So yes, okay, Tom and Vera on the outside looks like it's a post-recession romantic tragedy, but you could also look upon it as a portrait of a relationship and how it's infected by mental health issues. So I it's never so clear cut, I think, that you take on a single issue and it doesn't bleed into other aspects of human existence, you know.
Marcus, coming back to Winners and Losers, your show at the festival, you talked there about, you know, the class conflict at the heart of it. For people who haven't seen that play, tell us a little bit about it, because I know that friends of mine, I haven't seen it, friends of mine who have seen it, were very taken by it and by the simplicity of seeming simplicity of the conflict at the heart of it?
Well, at the heart of it is a game, honestly. It's a game we play, Jamie and I, that we dreamed up really in relationship to kind of a peripheral kind of acknowledgement of the competitiveness of our own relationship and very personal relationship. And we would name a person, place, or thing and debate whether it was a winner or loser, like from Pamela Anderson to the Irish economy to whatever. And so we would
winner.
Do that. Yes, Irish economy winner. It's going to be. It's going to rebound. Yeah. Well, it's interesting, right? Like, because anyway.
We're not in the recession. So,
yeah, exactly.
There's no recession now.
Exactly.
Right? It's over.
It's over. Yeah. And there's a new housing bubble I read today, actually. But that was funny.
Loser.
Yeah, loser. Well, or it depends who owns it. But that's the game, right? Exactly the game. And we also would debate with each other who's the better father, who's the better lover, who's, at one point, who's the better masturbator, who's the better cook, you know, et cetera, et cetera. We recorded and transcribed all those. And again, in this investigation of competition and to what extent it's an engine and how it operates between us, and then shape the piece out of that. The thing around class was a choice. To make that the kind of thing that the show turns on in the end, which is kind of what happens, that was a very specific choice, a kind of ideological choice in a way, like our kind of perspective or point of view. But the game itself is that very simple construct.
You would argue that artists are perhaps afraid of politics and shouldn't be, that they regard politics as something dirty that might be contaminated by, and you would say that's wrong. Artists should get involved in politics.
Yeah, and that for me operates in I guess two different ways. We are very apolitical, you know, and there's that interesting thing where, like, you know, I feel like the feminist movement's, it's almost a cliche, but the feminist movement's great, one of their great gifts to us was the personal is political. The search for how the political is personal, I think, is one that we're still really working on. And I do. I feel like theater artists, whether critics or, you know, theater people, we have tremendous skills, and we think we tend to hold ourselves above politics, particularly formal politics. Certainly in Vancouver, it's seen as dirty, not worth our time. It's that malaise, right? You were talking about it, right? That sense of disenfranchisement. And yet, what we bring to the room potentially seems to me, which is kind of antithetical to the way politics is practiced, which is often so much like bad theater, right? Like with everybody knows everything and you're absolutely sure and all that kind of stuff, that we as artists actually have opportunities to reinvigorate that process.
Joe, is that something you would echo?
You know, I live in London. I come back frequently. I probably reside, or well, I do actually reside much more in the film world. And there is a kind of, as you're developing a script, and this would be applied to a theatre script, as you're developing the text, you get notes back from your chosen editors, and the phrase is often, too on the nose. And I kind of feel that maybe filmmakers, certainly theatre makers, might feel that it would be very too much on the nose for them to engage in something so bald as class struggle or the issue to do with sex and so on and so forth, that it seems somehow not to incorporate the full sweep of human emotions. But I would imagine that's really a starting point, because I think of about a great film, The Bicycle Thieves, and you think about that in terms of poverty and class and the kind of social context of Rome at the time, but then you can also look upon that as the relationship between a father and a son. So I think invariably it's an infinitely more complicated as a single issue. I think I would find it a bit of a yawn if the play was simply about you know, a particular issue, and it wasn't connected to other things, because everything is connected in that sense. So I would like to see that bleeding into the fabric of everyday life. But I kind of get the feeling that it may well be that if the play is so reduced to a one line, it's about this, but nothing else. And that feels quite a didactic position. Maybe that's why theatre makers shy away from it. But it may well be that if you look at the work, in the very backbone and spine of the theatre work, actually, a lot of the work actually is quite political.
Helen, in you know, your experience over the years as a critic, former editor of Theatre Magazine, do you feel there is a real engagement with political, again, in the broader sense that Joe was talking about, you know, where the personal becomes political, but also, you know, the broader political spectrum in Irish theatre?
Well, yes, I do. I mean, I'm particularly in recent years, say in the last 5 or 6 years, and there's some companies that have done extremely important and interesting work, particularly Anu Productions, I suppose the most obvious example, Louise Lowe's ensemble and the work that she's been doing over the last 4 years, called the Monto Cycle, site-specific, using installation, documentary, all sorts of different forms of theatre and address, and looking at, what she's looking at, though, is recent history. It's not the current crisis. It's going back to 60s, 70s, 80s. It's going to take us up to the present. And I do think that's an important point. I think a certain amount of distance is sometimes needed for an artist in any discipline before that, you know, she or he can say something or wants to comment, however obliquely, you know, on our times. You don't necessarily want an immediate response, because that's in a way the function of journalism, of reportage, of documentary. And there's no reason why theatre can't incorporate all those, I suppose, media. But if you want a piece of work that's going to speak to you, maybe, and also going to speak to people in 20 years' time, it is, I think, just as Joe says, it doesn't have to be overtly addressing an issue. It doesn't have to be overtly political, uppercase P, but it has to tackle what it is like to be alive in the world now. And that can incorporate all sorts of issues, such as social injustice or gender politics or politics in a formal sense. But it isn't necessarily an immediate response. I think any writer needs time to, our artist needs to reflect and needs to sometimes come at things at an angle.
I suppose in terms of on-the-nose plays, you know, we might think about Colin Murphy's Guaranteed or yeah. Anglo the Musical, I suppose, both seeking to engage very directly with the recent inglorious history of our banks and some of the politicians here.
Yes, and also, but sometimes people have used older plays or Greek tragedy. I mean, there's quite a strand of Irish theatre that has taken, you know, Aeschylus or I suppose I'm thinking of Conall Morrison's work with Greek tragedy, both in the Abbeyan project, and also taking Agamemnon, the Raw Theatre Company, doing this sort of turning Greek tragedy into a sort of a satire on the Irish property boom. So there's all sorts of ways you can take older theatre and make comments. But again, I always feel the less explicit and didactic, or, you know, not in every case, but often that's the most telling, and that's the one that's more resonant for audiences.
I remember seeing a production of Antigone in New York about 5 or 6 years ago, and even though it was really quite straight, it spoke volumes about the Gulf War.
Well, back to Ibsen or Chekhov or, you know, any of the great 19th century playwrights, you don't have to spell out sometimes their contemporary resonance. They actually speak to us because our world hasn't changed that much, and human beings don't change that much over a millennia.
Fiacca, I wonder, in terms of scripts coming into the Abbey in the last, we'd say, 5 or 6 years, have you received many scripts seeking to engage, perhaps too directly, with very recent events, especially economic events here?
Not really. I mean, I think my job as director of the Abbey Theatre is to provide a context, and probably a political context, okay? I wouldn't dare ask a writer to write about a particular theme, although we might speak about a particular subject matter, okay? And I think I would agree with Joe that there are multiple layers by which you can approach a piece of theatre, and there's also we are very, very secure in allegory, you know, and I think that's the strength of Irish theatre, the strength that we can speak from both sides of our mouth, you know, and often if it's good, it's great. If it's not, it can be seen as kind of too pragmatic. But like the devices we use at the Abbey often are about providing that context and placing plays, whether it's plays from the repertory with new plays, and also some interventions. So at the height of the crisis, I invited David McWilliams in to create a piece of theatre or performance called Outsiders, which was so clear and so on the money in terms, on the nose, but I wouldn't call it necessarily a piece of theatre, but it was a performance that actually, you know, it was performance economics in a way, but it was, you know, that was part. On the other side then, you look at playwrights and you have to trust them, and we want to trust them, where you put a play like Be for Baby or Marble. One of the great taboo subjects in Ireland is affairs, you know, where you want to sleep with your best friend's wife. What the implications of that? You want to get rid of your children. So a play like Marble or a play that Sam Shepard did, really, First Age of the Moon, yeah, has all that. So it's about having that push-pull where you're absolutely aware and trust artists to tell whatever story they want and need to tell. I can provide the context, the political context, but they don't have to.
Willie mentioned the barricades earlier, and I think early enough on in your tenure at the Abbey, you'd said that you believed the Abbey should be at the barricades. As well as some of the plays you mentioned, are there particular productions in the past 8 years that you believe has brought the Abbey to a point of artistic confrontation with social and political traumas here?
So I said that in 2006, and I also used the word citizen. And the word citizen at the time was a word that was not used regularly or not used at all. In fact, one could argue the word consumer was a much more important word. And what I was trying to say there was that as a unit, the Abbey Theatre had not in any way engaged with the political system, had not in any way engaged with politics or with debate, that we have to be careful in terms of how we program work, but ultimately that the role of the Abbey Theatre, the role I saw as the Abbey Theatre, my successors can do, was that we should be in the game highlighting what artists are saying, what Tom Kilroy calls playwrights are prophets, writers are prophets in the original word. You know, you talk about the great play by Tom Murphy, any of the great plays, but certainly The House, which we produced last year. That's an extraordinary play. It is probably one of the most political plays. Now, Tom would say, really? Is it political? It's about a family, but it's about a family, it's about property, it's about immigration, it's about... And so we didn't write the press release saying it was political. So my role is to contextualise that, place it within the programme. So certainly what the Abbey Theatre have achieved is we're in the game discussing, whether it's with politicians or opinion makers, I think, and encouraging that debate, whether it's on the stage or off the stage. So I would say the barricades have become virtual now, haven't they? And that's probably it. And who the opposition is and who's in control, I suppose none of us are in control at the moment. But I think that debate also seems to be very healthy in the independent theatre sector as well. And again, back to the issue, Vincent, is that I see a distinction between the role of the artist and the role of the citizen artist. And I think that's where we need to, and that's where my role as director of the Abbey has, is how we encourage the role of the purpose of the citizen artist. The artist is the kind of the soul, the prophet of this society, and we need them to take leadership. And perhaps in other societies, whether it's France or Britain, they do that. Harold Pinter did it, and I think that's something that I'd love to happen.
In your own engagement with politics, you know, the first Abbey director since Yeats to be appointed to the Senate and politically involved through We the Citizens, have you encountered real passion or interest about theatre from other politicians? I mean, do they see theatre as something urgent? Do you find many of them coming to the Abbey to see productions, or is there much conversation or discourse around theatre or the arts?
Well, I mean, I'll drop a name. Myself and Joan Burton were speaking about Shaw in the Doyle Bar only yesterday, okay? And she is quite an expert at Shaw and was quite critical of the production. Well, not quite critical, but we understood.
Of Major Barbara.
She's a Shaw fan. But on a serious note, I see theatre as a part of an overall framework of citizenship. All right, and for a citizen to be a full and whole and contributing part of society, access to theatre and access to the National Theatre, but any theatre, is an elemental part. So when my role as director of the Abbey and how I use my role as a senator is to get that engagement going, whether you call it lobbying or whether you call it opening up, that actually the right to be able to read and write and vote is the same right, equal to the right of accessing the arts or accessing theatre. It doesn't matter what theatre is. And certainly what we're doing actively is through our own community and education programme is we're now working with a lot of the short courses on the junior cert, and we're doing a theatre and citizenship with the Larkin Community College. And the more theatre as a unit, not putting that responsibility on the artist now, or the player, but as a unit, as a community, can actually get more involved in political discourse, social discourse, the better, in my view.
Willie, you've been involved in Irish theatre for many years, and here at the project, you've facilitated young companies, young theatre makers, who sought to make new work sometimes in new ways. Do you still see that kind of passion among young theatre makers, a passion for perhaps finding new ways of expressing things, a new theatrical language? You know, we were talking about technology, not just bringing technology in for the sake of it, but an attempt to engage in a real way with a new form that can illuminate something for all of us.
I certainly think there's been a flourishing in theatre in recent years, even though some people thought that we were apolitical and so on. But I want to come back to this, an idea of what we can expect of theatre, what theatre can do. You talked about seeing that production of Antigone with people in, I imagine, in combats. And it seems to me, I've seen lots of production stills of shows with people in combat, sometimes even when the action is not set in the Middle East, it alludes to it. So you're thinking like, well, what happened to metaphors? Do we have to be so literal every time?
Actually,
so
I don't think there are any combats.
Well, I'm thinking of one that I saw, which I won't reveal which it was, but it was set on the continent of Europe. But there's that visual shorthand. We allude to the current war to give the production some kind of heft. You think actually maybe a really good production of Antigone has sufficient metaphorical impact anyway. What's interesting is, I suppose there are a few things. One is the Ireland's past and trauma and giving witness. So if you think of the Monto cycle, three so far, fourth to come next year, or if you think of Broken Talker's work like The Blue Boy, or even Gerard Mannix Flynn's James X, that's explaining a historical wrong. That's one thing. And the question is, that might be a good gift for posterity, but we need some analysis now for action now, because we have a current crisis, a political crisis. And at the same time, you're looking around to say, what kind of playwrights or what kind of theatre makers have responded to the crises? No Escape used a report. It wasn't a piece of playwriting. Dave McWilliams' text was an economics lecture, if you like. It's not necessarily a play, which is not to say that playwrights are not interesting, but there are many different formats or options for making theatre. But the question I come back to, which is, what's the difference between a prime time and a play? What do each of them do? Is one just stating facts? Is the other alluding to something, I don't know, of a higher order, more poetical? But another thing is this idea of artists having reservations about engaging in politics. Artists are not some alien species. They're people. They're citizens too. So is that like citizens giving themselves permission to opt out because they're artists? And actually, at the moment, I think in a way, without wanting to overstate it, to be an artist is political, because certainly Fiac and I and others who've been involved in the National Campaign for the Arts, what we hear is, oh, that's nice, but lads, the economy is the priority. So it's as if the economy is not made up of people. We're in a crisis, so we can't afford to have the conversation about other things. And of course,
the thing is now, what's going to happen is poverty is going to become the biggest censor for artists from now on, and that, you know, one could argue that might be deliberate as well from the government point of view. It's, you know, that actually starving in terms of the funding straight to the artist, and it's kind of ironic when the eulogies for Seamus Heaney were occurring that artists on the ground are not being able to earn not only a living but are being challenged in the Dáil offices about getting a different job.
So it's a question about values. Is art a useless activity? It might be, in strictly economic sense, a useless activity, but socially it's a useful activity. And if we want people and the economy to flourish, these people's intellectual property, if you want to be crude about it, needs to be invested in. We're not a country that has abundant natural resources. We are abundant in people, so long as they don't emigrate at 1,000 a week. So I think to be involved in the arts is in a way to be political. And we have to think, of course, that we are a society, not an economy.
Marcus, I presume you would be glad of this debate. I mean, would you have a debate like this in Vancouver? You said that Canadian theatre in general seems quite apolitical and conservative. And is there much debate around the role and function of theatre makers in society in Canada?
Well, there is something thrilling about being here. Just the depth of the depth of understanding and the depth of the kind of it feels like primarily the kind of the literary side of the theatre tradition, and just the knowledge and the proximity that people feel to it is heartening to be around, because we don't have that. I mean, one of the interesting things that we face, sure, we sit around and debate about whether we're valued, whether we're considered part of the economy. All those things are part of conversations we have too, and whether we're all going to be broke, etc. But one of the interesting things about being in a new place, and we are a very young place, we don't have these kind of historical icons living in our heads in the same way, but one of the interesting things about there, that is that there's not a presumption of necessarily a value in traditional forms. I come from traditional training. I'm a playwright by trade. That's what I do. That's what I started doing. But there's also inside of that a kind of opportunity to look for new ways to engage audiences. And so in our work in Vancouver tends to be often spectacle-based, often driven, but there's lots of site-specific work. There's lots of ways, because we don't automatically assume people will come to the theater, because they will not in many, many cases. And so we have to find other ways to reach them, which can be great. And we've connected to the international network in some ways as a community, and that has a lot of that kind of work happening in it too. I think what we really need to do is to look to, or what I'm interested in is looking to unite those two kind of strands, because if I have a criticism about our work, it's that it's too formalist in nature. It absents itself from real questions about, what we're all doing here and what our lives are like. And so but there's something exciting about that feeling of liberation in terms of form.
Helen, there's an obvious reality around the economy impacting on theatre here in terms of cuts to funding to theatre companies. But yeah. I also wonder about empowerment in a discussion like this. I suppose many people here may recall Robert O'Mahony addressing the frustration of Irish theatre artists very effectively at the Actors Forum in the Gate Theatre earlier this year. Perhaps we'd have more socially or politically charged work if theatre artists were freer and stronger and the layers of bureaucracy were fewer.
Perhaps. it's hard to know.
Perhaps not.
To take the question about theatre makers and empowerment, it is true that opportunities for making theatre are shrinking, and to do with the funding that Fick mentioned, but also the fact that the three main theatres have the sort of the lion's share of the resources, and a lot of theatre makers now feel that they might, if they're lucky, make one production per year on project funding, and that for the rest of the year they're trying to figure out what on earth to do. But I still think, yes, they could, when they do get their opportunity to make work that reflects that frustration and the feeling of marginalization and the lack of respect for them as an artist, but they actually may choose to make something completely different, So it's, you cannot, I suppose I feel you cannot prescribe what somebody's, the work that they're going to make, but of course the work will reflect the conditions of its own creation.
Joe, I was reading an old interview with you and Christine Malloy of Desperate Optimists, and I have to say, I love that name, Desperate Optimists. I suppose it applies to all of us at times. And I think it was an Irish Times article in the 90s that described you as something between theatrical terrorists and community activists. Do you feel that description still fits at all?
I don't think it fit at the time, actually. I mean, I think we terrified ourselves sometimes.
You terrified me?
Well... No, I no, it doesn't. I was just thinking though about audiences, because we are very involved in cinema, and some of our close friends take the form of theatre. They go to theatre with a certain expectation, and they demand something from it in the way that they demand something from visual art and literature. But curiously, with cinema, they demand very little from it. They really want to go to cinema to escape. And I kind of think, oh God, what a shame that you don't, give cinema the potential power that that these other forms have, and are probably taken more seriously. Because you recall those times when you'd be watching, Fellini in the 70s on BBC Two, and now it's very hard to see anything serious. And so if we're not careful, you will gradually unspool everything, that people begin to look at any art form, particularly theatre and cinema, because of the level of, support, financial support they need. It'll diminish, and people will expect it to do less and less, or they might want it to do just very frivolous things, or perhaps really to escape. So I kind of feel it's a dangerous time because certain things can get rubbed out in this particular process. And there's, for sure, there'll be people seeking to do that in this current climate. I mean, the big thing that you do notice in the UK, they talk a lot, is actually about the cultural industries having a great net benefit to the economy, and not to just assume that it's a drain. It's, if you start taking that out of the question, or you start losing that debate, I would draw a line in the sand of that. I think they're incredibly important to the economy.
The difficulty in Ireland is that the strongest arguments we can make are for international reputation, bed nights, economic multipliers. We can't make the fundamental argument, or we haven't succeeded in making the fundamental argument, and it's not enshrined in policy around the benefit to people and to people's lives of a form of cultural enfranchisement.
I mean, that is the key, isn't it? And it's something that Willie and I, we're doing a lot of work in the campaign, the background that is that actually, can we make, we haven't, 90 years, whatever, after our, not 90, I'm crap at maths, 90, whatever, we yet in three or four sentences cannot advocate clearly and ideologically about the role of the arts and arts without appending it to either jobs, tourism. And that's a load of bollocks, and it's really unfortunate. And for us, it's something that we have to actually, that we need the self-confidence to manage, and I think that's a worry. I mean, I'm involved in the Global Economic Forum next Friday, and we're trying to look at how we understand the arts within an Irish context, an international context. Never mind trying to look at what the added value is when it comes to jobs and that's a very reductive argument, but it's also a very depressing argument, and that's something we have to watch out for.
Yeah, and I completely do agree with that, and to say that I think that we haven't been insulated. What's happened to the to our collective cultures over the last 30 years? We've gotten very good about talking about diversified revenue and net economic benefit and multipliers and all that. We've gotten extremely good at that, and it's paid off for us. Our Arts Council funding has gone up in the last 10 years, but I would also argue that as artists, or some of us anyway, like we're not making escape. That's not what we're doing and what we're here for. And our marginality in some ways is our greatest asset, because that is our function. And how is that affected when the language and everything we do is filtered through this prism that is the kind of like dominant global kind of economic ideology? What does that do to us? What does that do to the way we perceive ourselves as a place where dissent is not every moment or whatever, but it is possible? And we are in an environment in which I would argue dissent is less and less possible. Like, we have a crisis of journalism. You said the thing about journalism. We have a crisis of journalism. In some ways, I feel like the theater needs to respond, because our journalism is virtually, our main or our popular journalism is virtually non-existent and is owned by one person.
But
single person.
I mean, Helen will remember
globally,
her days.
More and more like that.
There is no arts journalism left in the
broad media.
Exactly. There used to be a time when there would be regular, either daily or twice, like arts journalism. Not puff pieces, not pieces about selling a show, but like in the newspapers, and that slipped away as well. So I mean, and that's something we have to advocate for within the theatre community.
Absolutely.
Well, the Independent in the UK have cut their arts desk.
Yeah.
So
And I think what's really interesting. I've been watching the Independent in London to see where are the readers shouting for, where we need good arts journalism. This is going to disappear. They've gone to The Guardian, but that's
only one.
But a lot
of that's
one.
Gone online.
Yes,
The Guardian as well.
A great deal is not printed. Well, obviously that's a real economic problem, and for the newspaper industry facing a crisis. Why should you give everything away free? And what happens? How do you claw back from that? And that is particularly affecting cultural journalism.
But then you think about some of the great articulators like Jonathan Romney, who I think is one of the best kind of writers in cinema, and you think, God, I hope Jonathan gets a job soon, because we're going to miss that voice
as a blogger. Yeah.
Everybody will go and blog.
Sure.
But how are they going to live?
Helen, Willie earlier said that sometimes in Ireland there can be a kind of insularity around how the themes we view as important in theatre, perhaps the economic, etc. I know you were at a theatre conference theatre festival in Portugal. I'm just interested in the work that is seen in other countries. Now, thinking about Germany and plays like The Master Margarita and Black Rider, plays that we don't necessarily get to see here. Going away, and looking at theatre somewhere like Portugal, do you feel another edge of engagement that we perhaps sometimes miss here?
Well, I think the only time we see great international work is during the Dublin Theatre Festival, really, and that's, I suppose that's one of the great joys of it. But yes, going to Portugal, I was struck by an economy going through similar sort of trauma, and there was a lot of very direct comment on that, and also about the role of the citizen, and there was a lot of work that drew on amateur and local community participants. So there was certainly a theme going through this. It was called PT13. It was more of a platform, really, for theatre and dance programmers rather than a full-blown festival. But it was a way of sort of showcasing the best Portuguese work. And there was an emphasis on the voice of the ordinary person, so-called ordinary person, and putting that on stage. So that to me was very striking. You know, sort of a reaching out to out of the sort of beyond the walls of professional theatre. It was about, I suppose, that engagement between professional and community. But that is happening here as well. You know, and I just think of somebody like Grace Dias and Theatre Club, and the sort of, she's a very young theatre artist making incredibly socially engaged work, very much focusing on drugs and addiction. And the blight that places on families for more than one generation, and not only in Dublin, but she's also working in Limerick too, and that she's working with local communities. I mean, I suppose people tend to say that the younger theatre artists are not politically or socially engaged, and I don't think that is the case in Ireland. I think the recent Dublin Fringe Festival has shown some very, very interesting work, including a piece that by Gavin Kostick, actually The Games People Play, that's quite similar in theme to yours, so a different form, but the sort of the middle class marriage, you know, under great, great pressure because of debt, mortgages, you know, just and sort of everything that you're expected to do, people thinking that they were doing the right thing during the years of the boom, that you acquire this property, that you have your children, that you, everything is going to go along on a certain path, and then it's just the ground is taken away from you, and there's a lot of emphasis on the effect of unemployment in the work that I saw in Dublin Fringe Festival in all sorts of different ways. So I'm actually very optimistic about what's happening in particularly in small independent theatre, except that the only thing you worry is the sustainability for those young people and those companies. And you know, once the great buzz of making your first or second or third show on a fringe, on a shoestring begins to wear off and you start to acquire other responsibilities, well then where do you go? And that is a big, big question about funding.
And of course, we think of somebody like Don Kelly as well, in terms of political theatre and a show like Ella Lou Fanula.
Yeah.
And it was people like that around the country making their work, going out consistently, just hammering away at it. And I suppose, in a sense, they do keep a certain flag flying. Willie.
Also, with an artist like Don, you look back to his previous career with Calippo Theatre Company when he was doing plays like Asylum, and The Business of Blood, and Far Away. But Marcus mentioned dissent, there's a kind of a consensus around the table. So I'm trying to imagine from the other people, the people who might dissent with our opinion and say, why don't you just participate in the free market? And if your stuff doesn't fly, well, then just deal with that. It has no value. I guess it is. I would judge a society on the capacity to which it can subscribe to dissent. Not just, theatre is not just about human flourishing. It's actually about trying to think through awkward problems. So simply just to push it away because you can't sell enough tickets to pay for it. We need to actually invest in these ideas. And of course, you mentioned Seamus Heaney, one of his many great legacies. So I think like one side of the equation, we have metaphors, and the other side, we have equations. And we're from the metaphor side. So Seamus Heaney's great, one of his great contributions was the couplet from The Curate Troy about hope and history rhyming. That was a very valuable contribution. Politicians, though they don't go to the theatre that much, in my experience, there are some exceptions. They liberally avail of metaphors from theatre and from poetry. So they need to kind of pay it back.
Will they, is the question.
That's our challenge. We've got to get the politicians in to see our work, and that's, you know, and spending as much time, more probably time, than getting the Irish Times reviewer in. You know, we've got to start looking at that, and you know, we spent quite a lot of time trying to do that. I know a lot of our members in our campaign trying to do that locally.
Our political system doesn't produce 3 free hours in the evening because they're either back in their constituency or in the Dáil, lashing through guillotine bills.
Fiacca, I imagine there'd be a bit of a troop of politicians into the Abbey around the centenary of the Rising around 2016.
Military metaphor there, Vincent. You know?
Looking ahead to that, what are the plans without, you know, giving everything away? Are we looking at a season of O'Casey, for example? I mean, are we looking at some
not
of the classic plays around?
Even my board would ask me that question, Vincent. I suppose, it's exciting. To answer your question, In early January, 16th to the 18th of January, we have a major theatre symposium called the Theatre of Memory, where we're going to look at those challenges. I mean, the challenges with the Abbey Theatre are that we were also involved, participants, Helena Maloney, Sean Connolly, all involved in the in 1916 and indeed the 1913 lockout. So I don't know whether we do, Sean or Casey or not, but what we will be looking at is both how to reimagine some historical work, but at the same time, looking to younger artists to respond to that. And ultimately, if we're not looking forward, I think now the tension there is that there would be pressure perhaps to recreate somehow history. And I think I would not be interested in that. I think reimagining myths, new myths, basically lying, telling a few other stories, I think is something that I think will be an important way for us. And I think there are opportunities, I think, for certain playwrights that we're going to commission to develop that, you know.
Willie.
I think we shouldn't talk exclusively about young artists. As somebody who, let's say, is somewhere in between young and old, we should think about, ask it of all artists. We're all citizens. You're not exempt suddenly because you become older, in the same way you're not exempt because you're an artist from being a citizen.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of middle-aged artists, right?
Call a spade a spade.
Except I'm not an artist, right? But, you know, one of the extraordinary pieces, which is what I love about the Fringe Festival, one of the extraordinary pieces in the Fringe Festival was by what I would call, they're going to kill me when I say this, but they did a production of Act Without Words, Sarah, I think Raymond Keane, Sarah Jenkins Cafe, and Brian Burroughs, and it was a non-verbal piece set in a car park within the shadow of Ulster Bank, you know, on the quays, and it was an extraordinary piece of work. Now, what that did to me was, I went, you can still go back to the classic repertoire, brilliant theatre, reimagine it, place it in a physical context, it's also already in a psychological context, and actually, so one, you know, so there's that nice choice between doing work that has a kind of a confessional or a bearing witness. There's nice work about site-specific accounting, and there's also work from the repertoire that could be reimagined. And so I'll doff my hat off on that. I thought that was for us a kind of a hope as well, that one can reimagine texts, place it in a different context, and still have resonance.
A lot more we could talk about. I'd just like to open this discussion out briefly to our audience and ask if anyone has a question they'd like to put to any of our panel members.
There seems to be a consensus among the panelists that good art shouldn't be didactic art. And I suppose my question, I'd like to question or challenge that consensus on the grounds that there are many different forms of didacticism, some which are more complex and dialogic than others. And of course, I understand the point that, you know, one might be put off by the sound of axes grinding in a work of art. But at the same time, isn't it true that some of the greatest works of art in human history, including perhaps the in this year's festival, the Three Penny Opera, have been examples of art that teaches?
I just want to jump in on that one, too, because I didn't speak to that, and it was something I was thinking about a lot, too, because I agree with you absolutely, like Brecht or Clifford Odets, or, you know, you can go down a long list of folks who use didacticism. But I think the reaction, because I have that reaction, too, and I think it's certainly something a lot of my colleagues have in Canada. Like, the minute somebody says it's political art, they go, oh, my God, no, no. And it is that reaction to the, you know, kind of large amount of bad political art that we've seen, and I don't mean necessarily didactic, but I think the difference for me, or the thing I always kind of attempt to go into a piece with, is if I, you know, it's just that simple thing. If I know the answer, and I'm telling the answer, there's no room for anybody else. And I don't think that's what Brecht did. Brecht used didacticism, but he was not telling us the answers. And so it then feels like bad politics, which is often really just bad theater. So I think, for me, that's the distinction.
Yeah, I don't remember the word good being used. I just qualify that. I don't think anyone around the table actually said good equated to in the phrase that you said. And I'm sure Brecht at the time, building on his predecessors, one of the things that Brecht was definitely interested in, again, I come back to that earlier comment, was not just the content, but how it's expressed, the form, and those breakthroughs that he brought in. And I'm sure that got a lot of very angry responses at the time, because that form perhaps obscured maybe the content. And I'm sure that's not what he was about. I think it was the two working hand in glove. So if it was simply about the content, Well, then why put on a show is my point. And I think what's interesting about people like Brecht and filmmakers and writers and theatre makers is literally how they're shaping form. And I think that's far more complicated than, and I think you've acknowledged that anyway, than a piece of art being simply didactic. I think there was many other levels to that, including entertainment, for sure.
And I'm sure one could have very effective political theatre without words. Good visual theatre.
In the Eastern European tradition, when words were not possible.
Mm.
Yeah.
Was somebody else?
As a passionate lover of the theatre and an inveterate theatre goer for about 50 years now, the one little thing worries me about today, I'm wondering if Shakespeare were here today, would he go away kind of confused and feel he should be writing a play about tweeting rather than Hamlet, you know? And just my last comment is, like, all the time I go to the theatre, I suppose I always have the dream I'm going to see a great play. And to me, a great play is something I could have I could listen to it on radio, a new production, see it on television, go live to it every 6 months, every year. And if we tie down playwrights to too much topicality, especially on technology, are we limiting them from the great play stuff? You know? Thank you very much.
Just a very quick response to that. I mean, I keep thinking about playwrights or filmmakers or artists, and one of the first questions, well, certainly if you're taking on narrative fiction, and I guess cinema and theatre have a lot in common on that front, one of the first questions you're always asked is, what's it about? And you always feel you want to have a good answer to that question. And it's kind of important, certainly with film, in that you may have to be hovering around a narrative for 2, 3, 4 years in order for that film to be realized. And so you better be in love with that story and that narrative structure and understand it and actually want to express that to an audience. So I get the feeling that artists, writers, playwrights, filmmakers, they deeply want to connect with an audience, with their material. And they ideally would like that material to resonate at different levels. And it's really hard to conceive of a strong, the experiences that you've had over the last 50 years of going to theatre, where it was devoid of a political content or a political backbone, that's it also resonated on that level. And I suppose I also share that desire to go and see great theatre or film or novel, but they rarely happen.
I suppose that's an issue Fintan O'Toole brought up as well in the last few years. You know, where are the great plays now? And you're talking about Friel and Murphy, but I think there always will be great plays. And Willie, I know that for recent plays outside of Ireland, you were very taken by Jerusalem.
One of the articles Fintan O'Toole wrote on that topic, he concluded that the great new Irish play is Jez Butterworth's Jerusalem because it had many of the virtues of those Irish and prior to that Shakespearean plays. I wouldn't say that there are no good plays being written in Ireland. Of course not. But if you look at the ones that have been very successful recently, there's that. And also, I'm thinking of in another jurisdiction, Bruce Norris's Clybourne Park, which is an American story, but it has resonance, as Jerusalem also has resonances for people who are thinking about history and nationalism.
You know, I think we all hope for great plays and
there will be more, definitely,
in the theatre. That's it from this discussion at the Project Arts Centre. Thanks to our panel, Fiach McAneil, Helen Meaney, Marcus Youssef, Joe Lawler and Willie White. Thanks too to Eugene Downs, curator of the Dublin Theatre Festival Talks. Don't forget, the Dublin Theatre Festival runs until October the 13th. So do come out to play and to plays. We are back next week with another theatre festival debate. The artists are not at home, but maybe they are, and making great work, we'll find out. Sarah Binchy produced this programme for Arts Tonight. Andrew Kane and Kieran Dunn were on sound. Thanks to our audience. From all of us, goodbye.